Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 94 of Real Blend, a podcast that is being filmed in one unbroken, continuous Roger Deakin shot.
Ooh, I understand that reference.
Very fancy. Episode highlights. We're going to get to a lot of stuff this week as we head into the Thanksgiving holiday season. A ton of really great movies that are in theaters and some really cool films that we have seen most recently, that we're going to give you our opinions on, including 1917 reactions, and that's what that joke was all about. We're going to talk about Knives Out and the new film Queen and Slim, and we have an interview, as promised, last week with director Rian Johnson. I hope you guys all listened to Kevin's conversation with Jamie Lee Curtis last week, an unbelievably great interview. And so for that reason, I'm going to start with Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 Washington, D.C., co-host of the Real Blend podcast. Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you, brother. Yeah, great to hear from you. Good to see you again, Sean, even though we just saw each other for 3 or 4 days in Cabo for Jumanji, The Next Level. Gabe?
Hope you guys had a wonderful time. I really do. That sounds lovely.
Jake, good to talk to you.
Kevin, so were you the one telling me about the Kevin Hart video of him with the espressos?
Yeah, that was amazing.
I finally watched that, and he did not look healthy.
No.
At all.
Yeah, he had to go to the bathroom real bad. R-E-E-L. Yeah. Real bad.
Real bad. That other voice that you hear is Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hello, sir. How are you?
The voice that is dripping with FOMO over not going to Cabo. I had Cabo FOMO.
No, dripping with swag. You're dripping
sure.
with swag.
Let's go with that.
That's what I like to hear. We have, like I said, a lot of things to get to this week, but we start each episode now, recently, with our weekly poll. And I thought that this was a more balanced question than it ended up being. But the question was, you can see only one movie this December.
Sean.
It has to be, and I'll go from least to most popular.
Sean.
7% of the people said something else. And these were things that got mentioned. Little Women, Six Underground, which has a terrific trailer. Bombshell, which Jake saw last night and I'm seeing tonight. Kevin's already seen it. And Cats. All of those were mentioned under the something else category. 11%
Cats?
Said 19. Yeah, Cats got mentions. Yes. Tom Hooper listens to the show. 1917 got 11% and Uncut Gems got 13%. Now, before I get to the winner, those two movies are tremendous, and more people should be interested in going to see both 1917
not over the number one pick,
and
Sean.
Uncut Gems. Listen, I'm trying to support original cinema.
I get it. Okay, Martin Scorsese, calm down. But which one would you have picked if you were to vote?
I would pick like the 69 other people.
Yes. Okay.
Picked Star Wars Rise of Skywalker. So that was the winner in the weekly poll. And a few people, I'm thankful for everybody who legitimately played along. But the one or two people who were like, why is this even a question? Like, is this even a poll? And I thought that, you know, Last Jedi might have soured a few people on the franchise. But and we're going to get into this as a talking point a little bit later on. That nostalgia video that they put out to get people hyped about the 40 years of Star Wars. I especially want Jake to sort of weigh in on that. And then something very special happened in that video that got Kevin's attention too, and I want him to weigh in on that. BDK, throw us to the Rian Johnson interview. Tell us how this got all set up and how he was able to come on the show and talk about his new film, Knives Out.
Well, the Rian Johnson interview happened because of you, Sean. Sean, in all honesty, you and Gabe, I think, were working that relationship with Lionsgate. And it was, you know, it was a bunch of emails back and forth, but specifically Rian Johnson, we really wanted him because obviously we're a very director focused podcast. We welcome all walks of filmmaking on our podcast, but directors are generally our go-to. Mm-hmm. So Rian Johnson being one of the best directors in Hollywood today, to have him on our show is insane. And Knives Out is one of my favorite movies of the year. We all loved Knives Out. And I want to give a shout out to Jeff McCobb before I toss to this. Jeff, I mentioned last week, just again, he drove 45 minutes just to bring microphones, just so we could record this. And to be in that room with Jeff, who's a big fan of Ryan Johnson, and, you know, to actually sit down with Ryan Johnson and talk about a lot of things that have happened to him recently with all the controversy surrounding Last Jedi, how he got over that, and just the idea of some of the cool shots in Knives Out. We talk about Brick. We talk about his whole filmography, and he talks about a lot about what some of the things he wants to direct next. So here's Ryan Johnson for Knives Out.
Well, first of all, Ryan, this is an absolute honor. Thanks for being on the Real Blend podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Truly an honor. I want to talk to you about, so we have a couple different hosts on our show, Sean and Jake, and Sean actually gave this great question about when you're writing a film like this, when you're dealing with a whodunit idea, at what point in the writing process do you find who the killer is going to be? Is it at the beginning of the writing process? Do you find it midway through writing? Right. When does that come about?
Well, I mean, the way I write, and I've done this with all my movies, it's a little different than that. I start really, really structurally. So I start even more like satellite map, zoomed back, abstract than plot. I start with, and in the case of this movie, for example, you know, I love whodunits. I know I wanted to do a whodunit. But I also know one of the potential pitfalls of a whodunit is that it's kind of a big buildup to one big surprise at the end, which isn't all that interesting. Like, whodunit? Can you guess it? Can you not? Who cares? Kind of. So the idea here was to keep everything I love about a whodunit, but put the engine of a Hitchcock thriller in the middle. And so I have that idea, and then I zoom in a little bit more and I think, okay, well, that means we need a character that you care about throughout the course of it. That means we kind of maybe do this sort of thing, and that means we need this. And so as I'm filling in the blanks, I kind of create what I need to make that shape work, including the characters, including the plot. So it's not like I start with, what if this person did it in the library with the candlestick, you know, and then build it backwards or go forwards and discover that. I start thinking narratively about the shape of the whole thing and then create the pieces as I need them.
Were there alternate killers?
No, because
it was always just one.
Yeah, because if you work that way, you kind of, it's not even like a, you know, and the truth is they're kind of, hopefully you construct it so they're kind of dramatically can't be, you know. And I mean, there's only one way it really works because it's designed to work that way. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Now, I believe you shot digitally on this movie, and you shot film for a long time, and the movie still looks like film, which is interesting to me. When I found out it was digital, I was like, what, really? I was like, I had no idea. What was it like for you as a director working digitally, in the sense of like, did it affect the way you shot? Did it affect the way you filmed? Because film runs out, mags run out, obviously.
You know what was it like for you? Digital runs out too. You still gotta change the chip. Yeah, that's kind of a big lie of digital. You can just keep shooting and shooting. You can't. You still have a chip. It lasts a little longer than a big film thing, but not significantly though. So it's I didn't change my process at all on set. I'm not one of those guys who just keeps the camera rolling and goes over. It was still very much, you know, start, stop, just like I would shoot with film. It was almost like an existential crisis for me shooting on digital with this one, like the choice to shoot on digital. Cause I have just been a big film guy my entire life.
Was it your idea?
No, it was Steve Yedlin, my cinematographer's idea. And Steve and I have a very close relationship. We've been like best friends since we were 17 years old, and he shot all of my movies, which we've always done on film. And he's also an incredibly technically adept color science guy. And Steve basically has a, it's almost a philosophy. It's based in facts. It's basically, from Steve's perspective, right now with imaging technology, there's no reason that what you capture your image on needs to define the look of what you're doing. And so whether you shoot on film, what Steve told me over and over is it's harder for him to make film look like film than to make digital look like film.
Wow.
Because every single thing you see, whether it's shot on film or digital, it goes through the exact same digital post chain. And it's the exact same DI, the digital color correction process. And that means for the film, you have to scan the film into a computer and make sure you're getting fidelity in that step where you're doing the scanning. And then you have to take that image and color time it. And then you're going to either spit it out to a DCP or maybe go back to film at the end. I mean, the truth is there are movies every year that are shot on film that look more digital than our movie does, basically. Anyway, so Steve's whole thing is about I'm sorry, this is a very long answer.
No, this is interesting to me.
Okay, good. Yeah. So Steve's whole thing is if you know what you're doing with the color science, you can apply grain to it. We even applied a filter that imitated the halation, which is kind of the way that the light that flares discolor with film. He applied a gate weave to it, so the whole image is shaking a little bit the whole time, which indicates to your eye that it's film. And then he has a color science where he's emulated film and with his color curves and programmed lookup tables where it emulates the color of film. And man, I'll tell you, there's one shot in the movie that's on 35. For my birthday, Steve brought in a 35 camera because he knew I was heartbroken. We shot one film on 35. It's a close-up of Daniel. It's in the movie, and I'll be damned if you can tell shot to shot which one it is.
Why that shot was just?
It happened to be the one. Yeah, happened to the one.
I've seen it twice now. I want to know what it is.
I never want to tell anyone the shot. I'll tell you this. It's a close-up of Daniel during the final big library scene.
Okay.
It's nothing too special about it. Just a close up.
Is there dialogue in the close up?
Yes. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I'll look for it.
Take a look. See if you can spot it.
Okay.
You can't. Spoiler. You can't.
this is the game now. I'm gonna go out and see it like 10 more times. Yeah. Was there ever an idea of shooting Jedi digitally?
We shot about half and half.
Oh, you shot half and half.
Yeah.
On
and
that.
The truth is, we started shooting mostly film, and by the end, we were shooting mostly digital.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things I love about this movie, the idea I told you this when I saw you at Marriage Story, is this shot where Anna's character is coming out of the house after we find out what happens with the will reading.
Yeah.
And it's this gorgeous shot where the camera gets picked up as if we're kind of like going into the anxiety of that moment.
Yeah.
I think you told me at Marriage Story that you've been trying to do that shot for years. Can you talk about the history of why that shot never made it into another movie of yours and like what was the original design of it? What movies did you originally have it designed for?
I've tried to do it a couple of times where the idea of starting on a dolly and then a certain dramatic point in the scene switching to handheld. Hmm. I mean, it's not like a breakthrough idea or something, but it's just something that we've tried a few times and it's never quite worked.
But it immerses you in the moment.
That's the idea, is if you do it right, it pulls you into the headspace of the character. So, and the whole movie, I don't think there's any other handheld in the entire movie. It's a very locked down, solid movie. And so we have this shot where to get inside Anna's character's head, we start on a dolly, a very basic thing, and then suddenly chaos surrounds Anna and we just literally lift it off the dolly and go into handheld mode and go into a long shot from there. So yeah, it was gratifying to get that one in there.
Do you write that shot in the script? Is that
no,
something?
I don't like to write shots into scripts. I mean, I'm thinking visually while I'm writing, so I'm picturing shots while I'm writing. But when I'm writing, I'm really trying to write for a reader. Yeah. And to me, if I'm sitting there describing every single shot, that's just getting in the way of you experiencing the story as a reader. And I think I feel like I don't need to dictate shots because I'm going to be the one who's on set, you know, setting them up. Yeah. So, yeah.
One thing I love about your filmmaking over the years, and you and I did a Brothers Bloom Q&A in DC once, Brick, obviously, you make very, very awesome, unique films that speak to your voice. I know I'm watching a Rian Johnson film in the sense of like, I love your style. I love your taste, but everything still feels different every time. But I think you take risks, and I think more filmmakers should take risks in regards to storytelling and things they do. I read a great quote recently I'm sure you've seen it by now, by J.J. Abrams, who said that episode 9 is what it is because of the risks you took on episode 8. Mm-hmm. What did that mean for you to read him saying that? Because like that, I think that's such a cool thing. You're not making the movie that's already been made before. You're making your own movie. And I feel like 9 now seems like it's going to be a more risky film because of what you set up with 8.
Well, I mean, that was so incredibly kind of JJ to say that. I mean, I know, you know, I don't think JJ needs any inspiration from me. I think he's an incredible storyteller who I knew from the instant that he, you know, that he was doing, that he, you know, that I knew that he was doing 9. He's going to figure out a way that's going to both completely surprise all of us and satisfy us deeply at the end of the saga. So, but that was incredibly kind words from him. But
do you know where it goes though?
I'm staying. I want to sit down like a Star Wars fan and just get my popcorn and just be 10 years old again and see this whole thing brought home in a beautiful way, that surprises me. So
how can you be 10 years old again if you made the movie before it? Like, that's crazy.
You totally can. Of course you can. You snap right back into it, man. It's Star Wars, you know? It just, it takes you there. It transports you. The instant that John Williams score comes up, you know, the instant you're back in that world and it's just, you hear those lightsaber sounds, it's just... snap, you're back to being 10.
What I love about you as a filmmaker is when I watch a movie you make, I feel the passion of your film fandom coming through your work. We talked about Sleuth last night and films that have inspired you throughout the years. And you've made so many incredible films. You talk about this idea of Nathan and his scores and this music. When you're writing a script, how involved is Nathan in the process of what you write? Because a score is a leading character. A score can also give away clues throughout the film based on how music is used. How involved is the writing with that score?
Well, I'm rarely kind of going back and forth with Nathan while I'm writing, but when I get some, he's usually the first person I'll tell ideas to, and we will kind of bounce stuff off of each other. And then he's one of the first people I show a script to always. Mm. And we do back and forth, and he's very helpful in terms of giving notes, but mostly it's so we can start talking about tonally, where is this thing going to be musically? And Nathan. Talk about doing something different every time. Like Nathan and I love the challenge of what is the completely unique approach to the score that's going to serve this movie best. And that's, you look at Nathan's scores and they're so completely different, each one of them. And this is his first time working with a full orchestra. This is his first time writing for a full orchestra. Went out to Abbey Road together and recorded a full orchestra. It was so much fun. It was amazing.
Can I ask you what that looks like? So when you're at Abbey Road recording, is your film playing there like a normal scoring session?
No, they have it timed out with like a click track, basically. And so the conductor is like, then the conductor will have very often, like John Williams, when he does it, he has a TV where he can see it, but the orchestra can't see the movie. And they're just kind of going along to the timing of what the conductor is telling them.
As a filmmaker who does continue to use the same people in your filmmaking process, your cinematographer, your Nathan, your composer, when you do something like you mentioned John Williams and Star Wars, is that just a commonly known thing that when you pick up that movie, Nathan's not going to be involved? Do you have to break that to him? It's John Williams.
He understood. It's like,
it's got to be different working with a different composer, though.
It
would have
been funny if he was sulky about it. Like,
I can do Star Wars music, too.
I would love to hear Nathan's Last Jedi score.
Are you kidding me, man? No, it'd be fascinating. But listen, John, he's pure magic. You know what I mean? And Nathan would just, I brought Nathan to a few of the scoring sessions and Nathan was good.
I'm sure he's geeking out, man.
There's no one better than John Williams today. And it's, he's extraordinary. And it's the process with John opposite of the process with Nathan for me, in that with Nathan, we're very collaborative and we're in there together. We're in sync. We're hands on. With John, it's this magical thing where you hand him the movie. It's like Spielberg puts it, you give John your movie and he gives you a whole new movie back. You know, it really, you give it to him and he does his thing. There were only a couple of things where he played us and the first time you hear the cues that he's written is when you're on stage and they're being recorded by the full orchestra. And there's, cause he doesn't temp anything up. He just writes them himself at the piano and scores them himself by hand. And then you show up on the day and you hear what he's done. There were just a couple of scenes in The Last Jedi where I even like had adjustments for him, but mostly it's just like, yep, that's exactly what it needed.
I want to see you walk up to Williams and give him an adjustment.
Well, he's very, he's very sweet. He's very open to that. He's not like this is the way it is. Not at all. He's incredible. I mean, he's a collaborator and he's very, very creatively open to collaboration. He thrives on it. Yeah.
You look at something like Brick. We were just talking about Brick when you walked in the room. What is the biggest lesson you learned on Brick as a filmmaker that still is applied today to this Knives Out film? Like if you look back and go, I learned that and Knives Out is better because of that.
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, Brick was really the first time I worked with real actors. So, working with Joe Gordon-Levitt and Noah Segan, who's both of those guys are in Knives Out, and Nora and Lucas Haas. I mean, the whole crew, it was, for me, that was, I think, learning on Brick that I loved working with actors and that I took real, that was it became, when I stepped onto the set of Brick, it was the scariest thing in the world to me. Because I think you imagine that there's some secret language actors have, or you need to speak in some kind of code to them or something. And the instant I clicked into this thing of realizing, nah, we're just telling a story together. And if you can communicate clearly, like, and you, all you have to be is an audience for them. And you just have to react honestly in terms of what you're feeling from what they're giving you. And like, if that's not serving the purpose of the scene, then you talk out how to adjust, you know. But I don't know. I guess that was, you know, the big lesson from, the big thing I learned on Brick was that my favorite part of the process is working with the actors.
Is Noah's character in Knives Out you?
You know, it's Noah. I feel like it's kind of both of us. Noah, yeah. As Noah puts it, he gets to be like the audience. He gets to be like the fanboy who's just happy to be there and is soaking it up and enjoying it all. Yeah. So yeah, it is kind of me too. You know, I mean, the, like, for instance, one of my favorite types of scenes in all of fiction is the big denouement at the end where the detective lays the whole whodunit out in the library. And there's a moment during our version of that scene where Noah kind of, someone starts to say something that's going to interrupt, and Noah kind of shushes him because he's so excited about
he's so into the moment.
And that's how I feel about those moments. So
that's cool.
But hopefully that's how the audience feels too. You know, he gets to kind of be the one who's having fun.
Yeah. You think about, you mentioned Spielberg and filmmakers, and you are in a league where you are working on a level, in my opinion, where those filmmakers are. And I don't say that because we're sitting here, but I genuinely mean it. But I want to know, is there a story for you specifically where a filmmaker that you idolized growing up came up to you and said, Ryan, I loved that film that you made?
I mean, and
the one that hit you the hardest, maybe.
Yeah, there's nothing more powerful than that. I feel like I'm hesitant to say it just because it would feel like bragging, and I feel like I would be exposing that moment where it's just like a private personal thing somebody told me that. But I've had a few of those moments, and it's been, there's nothing that, it's almost too joyful to process when somebody who is your hero and somebody who you grew up watching their movies and somebody who you learned. I mean, in a way, you know, when they compliment you, they're complimenting themselves back, because I feel like these are people who I learned just by studying their films over and over. So I just, I always just, you know, I've just replied, you know, I learned it from watching you. I learned it from watching you, you know. But yeah, I've been very, very lucky to have a couple of those moments. They're really special.
That's cool. I'm glad. Yeah. I think that's cool that you keep them to yourself, though. Yeah. I appreciate that. Now, obviously, Breaking Bad, my favorite show of all time. I actually have a Walter White tattoo on
me. Oh, kid.
But you directed arguably the greatest episode in the show, Ozymandias, and the Fly. I love the Fly episode. You shot like some 16 and 8 on that, which is kind of cool. But you look at what happened with El Camino recently, which was, I thought Vince did a great job with it.
Gorgeous, man. It's beautiful. So beautiful.
What were your thoughts on where Pinkman's story ended?
That was perfect.
Did you envision him kind of coming out like that? Did you, like, when you were directing Pinkman's character and...
Do you mean at the end of
Breaking Bad
of the actual season, not at the end of El Camino?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't know what to... The great thing about Breaking Bad was you didn't know where it was going to go moment to moment. I mean, so no, it's not like I was on set with Ozymandias, and I didn't want to read the last... I think the last two scripts are floating around, and I purposefully would like stick my finger in my ears when people were talking about them. I really didn't want to know. And... no, I could have never guessed it. I mean, they went to such a dark place with it. Yeah. But then that was the beauty of El Camino. I think, you know, the moment in Breaking Bad where the last moment with Jesse is this cathartic kind of howl of release. And then to have this gorgeous, confident coda of El Camino, and to have... I don't know, Vince's filmmaking and his writing is so confident. It's so steady hand. He's got a steady hand. It's exactly what he's going for. And he just, he brings it there. And then to see this mature, beautiful performance from Aaron, I just loved it, man. Yeah. It was terrific.
It's gotta be cool to watch as somebody who was involved in that project. There's a great bit in Knives Out where Michael Shannon's character essentially wants to turn his father's books into movies, and Plummer's like, we're not doing this. I'm essentially taking you off this project. You're not gonna be working on this anymore. What is a book, in your opinion, that should never be turned into a film?
That's interesting. I never, if I love a great book, if I love a book, the last thing on my mind is adapting it.
Right.
To me, if I love a book, it's generally because the pleasure I get from it is tied directly to its form. And I think I've made the analogy before, like the idea of I love this book, let's turn it into a movie. It, to me, that's kind of like, I love these boots, let's knit them into a sweater. You know, it's just a film is such a different thing. But some of the best films ever made have been adaptations of books. And
Godfather,
some of my, yeah, no,
Jaws.
Godfather, yeah, no kidding. And some of, so what do I know? You know, so I'm, but it's just in terms of creatively how I think, it's, there's, you know, a move for me. And I think because I come up with my movies, I draw a lot of inspiration from books, but the story of a movie is a certain shape and a certain length. And I've always kind of come up with those from scratch, I guess. So if I'm reading, I'm rarely reading thinking like, how do I transform this into a movie?
Now, Evans' Eat Shit moment is, this is a podcast we can curse, but it's classic. I mean, it's in the trailers, it's great in the movie. When you wrote that, what was it any different from how you wrote it to how it ended up on screen? Do you remember filming it? Did you have him just say eat shit for like 2 hours? And like, how did that go down on the filming process? And how different was it from the writing of it?
Well, when I wrote it, it was fuck you. He goes, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you.
And, oh, I didn't know that.
Well, and I decided right before we started shooting, I was like, you know what? I really want this movie to be PG-13. I really, because I was thinking about like growing up as a kid watching those Peter Ustinov Poirot movies with my family and thinking that was the age when I got into this stuff. And I thought, you know what? Let's make this change and I pulled a lot of F-bombs. There were a lot more F-bombs in this.
It feels R though.
It's PG-13.
I know it's 13, but I think you still kept the tone of an R.
Good. Yeah. No. Well, we kept the tone, but not the F bombs. So.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think I worked with Chris to figure out what he would do, and we came up with each shit instead. Yeah.
I love character choices, and there's little things that always stick with me about what a character says or what they do. Two particular things I want to bring up to you: the flipping of Daniel Craig's coin.
Yeah.
Is that a choice you make? Is that a choice Daniel makes? And can you speak to maybe why you think he does that? Why does he hit the piano key the way he does? Like, what are these choices that Daniel comes up with, or do you say like, maybe you should try this? What does the coin mean?
Yeah, no, they're written into the script, and typically they serve, for me, if something's in the script, it's because it serves a specific story requirement. So, for instance, the piano, which in the script is a little different. In the script, I had him tapping the back of the detective's chair with his foot. But then when I worked out the geography, I'm like, he's going to be too far away, but there's this piano here. This is kind of weird, but what if you hit the piano key? And the purpose of that was to kind of, first of all, to hold off Benoit's entrance, to give Lakeith's character a little bit of room to establish himself, and also just to build the anticipation, and also just to kind of build up the weirdness of this character a little bit. You know, there is a logic behind when he's saying the piano key, but really it's just kind of a strange thing. Like when Toni Collette says, who is that guy? Where it's what we're all kind of thinking, you know?
Right.
And then the coin flip was even more one was just a very practical requirement of the story. I wanted something to indicate that in the, because we use it to go to a flashback.
Yep.
So when he flips it up in the air, we go to a very specific flashback, and I want to very clearly indicate when we come back that we're coming back to the exact same moment.
That's cool.
So I had that coin go up, and then we come back, it's up in the air, and we have it come down. And so,
if Evans asks for a cold glass of milk, what does that say about his character? Like,
it's just something that,
to me, it resonates as an audience member. It's something it grounds the character in a certain reality for me.
Yeah. And
so is that why you do it like that?
Well, that just kind of feels right. And that's also, it's kind of infantile, and it's kind of, there's something just annoying about people drinking milk and asking someone else for a cold glass of milk. It's almost like you'd ask your mom for a cold glass of milk. But it's just, there's something about it that makes him kind of, because at that moment he bursts in, and he's been set up as this kind of, infantile child, basically. So the notion that he's eating cookies and milk just seemed to me that would just tag that base of he's just kind of like a brat. You know?
And even like Anna's vomiting element. I mean, that to me is such a perfect thing to kind of interweave throughout the script, because then every scene later on, is she lying or is she not? It's such a great, that's such a useful little tool.
Well, and that again, to get back to each one of these things is really just comes out of story need. So with Anna's, you know, she her character has this thing where she can't lie. If she lies, she pukes. And the whole basis of that was, I mean, it's fun, but where it really came from is, you know, it's a character who's in a really tough situation that we want her to get out of, and her only tool for getting out of it is lying, and you want to make life as difficult for your characters as possible. So let's take away the one tool she has to get out of this thing. And then it's like, well, okay, so we give her a tell when she lies. Does she blink twice or like touch her nose or something? And then, no, it's more fun to have her puke.
Yeah, and I love that aspect of the movie. As you're watching the film, there are, like, you learn about these characters in very short bursts. Like Jaden Martell's character, we learn that like there's a lot of bullying going on in his regard. Like people are making fun of him, and I find that to be interesting because as somebody who was bullied growing up, and like any type of bullying that's happening now on the internet, things like that, I thought that was such a relevant and interesting thing to do. As somebody, as a reporter, you know, you get one or two negative comments, it kind of sticks with you and kind of hurts your feelings.
Yeah.
As a filmmaker, you're out there to the world, and people are judging your work, and people can send you messages. And I know you talked a lot about what happened with Last Jedi and kind of getting all of the controversial comments from that. How do you kind of come, like, how do you step aside from that and go, you know what, I'm going to continue down this path? Because I feel like a lot of people would kind of give up if they were getting negative comments. And I think that this is such a great film, and I'm just happy that you are doing the films you are. How do you move forward when you get negative responses?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, I guess a big part of it is, I don't know. On Twitter, like the reason I'm still on Twitter is because 95% of what I get on there is incredibly positive and constructive. And so it's more than balanced. So then bad is overwhelmed by the amount of good. I'm not even talking good in terms of people liking the movies or liking the stuff, but good in terms of people being genuinely good hearted and wanting to engage in a positive way, you know? And with Star Wars, that's absolutely the case, you know? So, you know, there is that balance. And in terms of the bad stuff, I'll tell you, it's interesting. That's been one of the really healthy things for me about the last couple of years is getting exposed to it. I mean, you know, before I made The Last Jedi, like I had never had anyone like hate me on the internet. If during the course of a year I got one negative tweet, I would go into a panic. I'd be like, oh my God, someone out there doesn't like me. I have to fix
this. That's how I get when I get one comment. I can't imagine a filmmaker.
The thing is though, I am really, really thankful that, because what that meant is that my sense of self-worth was attached to the notion of everybody liking me online.
Oh, interesting.
And the fact that this process has made me out of survival disconnect from that. And also, I think it's given me a more realistic view of the system that is social media. You know, it's, there's a lot of great, great, genuine interaction that goes on. I mean, the bad stuff, kind of the systematic trolling, the almost gamified abuse that some people devote their entire online presence to. Honestly, it kind of, once you've seen enough of it, you see the pattern of it, it kind of just gets boring after a while. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, it doesn't even like give me the little negative ping of, anymore. It's literally, and I don't think it's even my skin growing tough. It's just, I've put it into perspective and realized this is, you know, this is kind of a byproduct of this, you know, social Twitter system. There's going to be some degree of people where this is their hobby, basically. So anyway, but overall, I've found it's actually made me adjust to social media to where I am seeing it and using it in a healthier way, I think.
I'm going to hit you with two rapid fire questions because we have like 3 minutes left. One thing I want to know, I asked you about this last night. I want you to educate our audience on Sleuth because I have not seen it, and I know that there's multiple versions. I think Michael Caine was in two of them, wasn't he? Wasn't he like a 90s and a 70s version? But that's like one of the best twists you've loved as a filmmaker, right?
I love it. So just see the 70s version. Okay. The 70s version is the only one to watch. Watch the 70s version, which is Michael Caine and Laurence Olivier. The 90s version is not even, it's a totally different adaptation. And the 70s
one. Why was Caine in the adaptation?
Because, well, I mean, he played the opposite character. It was an interesting kind of flip, yeah. So anyway, it's Laurence Olivier and Michael Caine, and I don't know how you can get it right now.
I ordered
track.
It today.
Do you order it? You might have to order the DVD.
$11.99 on Amazon if anyone wants to get it.
Yeah, the less you know about it, the better. But it started as a stage play. It was done originally as a stage play, and it's just got, I mean, even besides the twists, it's two of the greatest actors just kind of going at each other for 2 hours with some of the sharpest dialogue possible. And the house that it's set in very much inspired the house in Knives Out. It's it's also, you know, Laurence Olivier plays a eccentric mystery writer, and the house is filled with his obsessions. And so you'll recognize a lot of the stuff from Knives Out in there.
Even involving all this press you're doing for Knives Out, have you had a chance to watch Mandalorian at all?
Not yet. I've been traveling so much, I haven't gotten to hook up my Disney Plus account. I started the registration process, and the wheel just kept spinning. I was like, shit, I gotta go to a screening.
I want you to guest direct in season 2.
Oh, dude,
would you do it?
Oh, hell yeah. If I had time to do it, I would get in there in a heartbeat, man. Yeah, I visited set for season 1. It looked amazing.
That's awesome.
It looked so much fun, yeah.
All right, last Knives Out question. Yeah. I've seen it twice. Yeah. I saw it at Toronto. I saw it here last night at the premiere. It's one of the best audience films I've ever seen in my life. And here's what I'll tell you, and I mean this truly. Last night we were at a premiere, and you know how Hollywood premieres can be like everyone in the room, we all know each other, and it could be like, you know, you don't know if that's an actual, a real life reaction. Yeah. But the reaction I had at TIFF was just with an audience, and it felt the exact same energy, which I think is a very rare thing.
That's awesome.
I'm curious for you as a director, when you watch a film with an audience watching your movie, what is the scene that you are most excited to see how people react to? And is it getting the reaction you intended?
Yeah, I mean, whenever the movie, because I've been around to a lot of these screenings now, and so I've hit the point where I don't sit through usually the entire movie, but I will always come back for the last 20 minutes.
Cool.
And for me, that whole last scene with Daniel in the library, then the whole ending of the movie, watching how that plays, I feel like I can gauge if an audience is clicked in. And I don't know. I typically don't love watching my own work with an audience. I'm usually curled up in a ball and really nervous. With this, it is a joyful experience.
Can you imagine
being
your 10-year self watching this movie?
Much fun. It's so much fun. It could be because what's going on up there is the actor, so I can enjoy their work all day long, you know. Yeah.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for
appreciate
having me,
the
man.
Time. Everyone listening to this, go see Knives Out November 27th. See it multiple times because it does reveal a lot more on the other viewings. And keep an eye out for that awesome dolly to
look
over the shoulder.
The shot.
Cool. Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks, man.
My favorite part of that interview, and the whole thing is spectacular, but Kevin, I know like you ask about film a lot. And when you get a great director who loves talking about film, and Rian Johnson revealing that on his birthday, they finally let him shoot with film.
That was so cool.
Now you got to go find that shot, the one shot that is used with film.
Which he claims is impossible that I will not be able to tell. Like, I guess it's one shot. He describes it in the interview that it's during the scene, no spoilers, vague, in the last 20 or 30 minutes of the movie, deals with the scene with Daniel Craig. And apparently in that scene, there's apparently a 35mm shot, which he said in the interview. But he said because of the color correction and all the things they were able to do to the digital photography they got on set, you probably can't even tell. It's probably matched so perfectly.
That's awesome. I'm going to go back through
it. This is kind of unrelated, but sort of related. I asked this question for you. Your passion is now seeping into my consciousness. Off camera, last week I interviewed the Safdie brothers for Uncut Gems.
Yeah.
And I asked them, and it's so weird that I asked them this because I genuinely don't care, but I asked them if they shot on film. And they said not only did they shoot on film, they took a pay cut to be able to shoot on film. Like, that's how passionate they are.
Yeah.
So they're like you. And then I walked out, and my cameraman that day goes, "Why'd you ask that film question?" And I go, "I genuinely don't know." He goes, "You never ask questions like that." I go, "I don't know." I was like, "It's because of Kevin."
Yeah.
Well,
the show is changing our lives.
And the Safdies, that's cool about the pay cut. Good for them. The Safdies have shot on 35mm for Good Time and Uncut Gems. And to me, to be honest, and I don't care if you bring the best cinematographer in the world on the show to disagree or agree about 35 versus digital, but I still think nothing will ever touch the way film looks, and you cannot tell me that Good Time and Uncut Gems would look that good and that gritty shot digitally. It would not be the case.
We have to bring Roger Deakins back onto the show. The fact that I'm even saying back, just so, but Kevin can stare into his eyes and say, "You're wrong, Roger Deakins, you're wrong."
I want to clarify something. I don't think Roger Deakins is wrong at all, and I almost
he's just not right.
No, no. Roger Deakins, the reason why he makes 35 or digital look 35 is because he is so seasoned in the way he shoots his scenes and the way he lights his scenes that he is able to achieve that look by the way he executes his shots on set and then whatever they do in post. Deakins is an example that should not be used in this case, in my personal opinion. I think he's one of the greatest cinematographers.
He's the exception, not the rule,
of all time. I mean, I disagree with him on film versus digital, but I have zero knowledge about how to shoot a movie, and he has 100% knowledge of how to shoot a movie. So clearly, it's a personal opinion, but I do have people on my side like Quentin Tarantino, Martin Scorsese, Edgar Wright, J.J. Abrams, Ryan Johnson. I mean, there's a lot of people who will come out and actually downright say, including the Safdies, who would take a pay cut to shoot 35 because they know that there's something magical about film. And honestly, Uncut Gems, this is going to sound really nerdy and super filmmaky-esque, but that movie, 35mm, is a character in that movie. It is a full-blown character in that film, the way that film is shot.
I want to leave Charlotte right now, as soon as we wrap the show, so I can be in D.C. to watch Kevin watch 1917. Oh. That's all I want to do. I would just sit. I'd sit back with my back to the screen, and I would just stare at him.
And Deakins is not wrong. Deakins is one of the few
is never wrong. Never
who
wrong.
Can actually shoot digitally and make it look like film. Hence Sicario.
All right, let's get to the talking points. I want to start with that nostalgic Star Wars video. So this came out, you know, everyone's kind of on board. I'm hearing this from a lot of people saying, I don't want to see anything else from Rise of Skywalker right now. You know, like we're this close. Don't show me any clips.
And then they release a clip and we all watch it.
Don't show me the trailer.
That clip.
Okay, well, let's start with that clip because I think that clip is really funny. I think that clip's funny.
Kevin
disagrees. I liked it.
Yeah, I did too.
But also, you said, my humor out of context. It's a 30-second clip. Humor out of context can be weird.
I will clarify something. J.J. Abrams is the reason why I'm excited about 9. But why did 4 characters have to tell us they were flying?
That's 4 funny.
Characters. I thought it's not funny, dude.
After the second or third, it starts to get less funny. Like, the fourth person, I think Oscar Isaac's the final one to say
three.
It.
There's 3. 3PO says it. Boyega says it.
Chewie says it. And Chewie says it.
You don't know Chewie says it.
Come on. Chewie. You don't know that. Chewie is definitely saying that.
Chewie
is
saying, Chewie could be saying, like, fuck, man, here they come.
No. You base Chewie's dialogue off of the reactions of the characters in the scene. And they're all reacting to that scene.
But he's not in the same shot with them. So it doesn't really make sense.
I like it.
Listen, I'm excited about Skywalker. I did not think that scene was great. It looked cool. That scene.
It reminded me of, did you get a Return of the Jedi feel?
Sure. Yeah.
Like opening, like I have a feeling that's probably the opening of Rise of Skywalker.
Oh, you think?
Gabe, are you with me on that scene?
Yeah, I bet that's in the from the opening.
Gabe might not have watched it. Did you watch it?
He hasn't watched it. Good for you. Okay. Did you watch it because did you not watch it because you're busy, or did you not watch it because you're trying to like hold back?
This would be a great opportunity for Gabe to have a mic. Yeah, we've discussed this off camera that it'd be
Let's be honest. He's imaginary. He's not real. There is no Gabe.
We are so committed to this bit. We are asking our imaginary friend questions. All right, I'm going to go on record as saying that nostalgia video did nothing for me. It didn't hit me in the feels in a way that I think it meant to. And I made a comment to Jake that is probably going to open up a really disturbing can of worms. And Gabe, I'm really sorry. I'm about to blow the entire doc up.
And the reason you made this comment is because I'm going back and rewatching all the Star Wars in chronological order and rating them and ranking them.
But so my takeaway, and Kevin, I don't think you've heard me say this. I think the Star Wars saga overall is more misses than hits.
I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
Completely agree with you. But here's the thing, though. On Jake's defense, The Empire Strikes Back is so damn good.
Sure.
That I think the misses that have happened in that franchise are I'm okay with because I'm happy Empire exists. And listen, I mean, New Hope. All right. That's actually an interesting thing. New Hope, Jedi.
Empire.
New Hope, Empire, half a Jedi, and then... The beginning of Jedi is way better than the ending. The beginning of Jedi, the first half.
No, the last 45 minutes of Jedi are some of the best Star Wars ever.
That's an opinion, but you know, it's all Ewoks or not, depending on what you think.
Thanks, buddy.
No, I love you, I think that Jedi is the weakest of those three, and I think you would agree too.
We're talking a 10 from Empire, a 9.999999 from A New Hope, and like a solid 9 from Jedi.
Okay, all right. So with that, those numbers, Sean technically is accurate. So if you think about it like this,
no, because I'd still give a high rating to Force Awakens, to Rogue One, to Revenge of the Sith.
Whoa. Sith has great scenes, but it's not a great movie.
The last 80 minutes of Sith is fantastic.
Okay, Jake, admit this one thing to me.
Yeah.
The prequels are generally considered to be misses. Is that a general consensus?
Yeah, but like I said, okay, so I'm going back and rewatching.
Generally.
Oh, no, you're absolutely
Solo
right.
Solo's
a miss.
Solo did not hold up as well for me as I thought it was going to, which hurts my soul a little bit.
Not because anything
was bad about it in my rewatch, but because there are no great Star Wars moments in Solo. Like, say what you want to about Revenge of the Sith, and even Phantom Menace. Say what you want to about Phantom Menace. That's a better example.
But
Star Wars moments in Phantom Menace.
I think they wanted the card game where he loses the Falcon to B1. I think they wanted him doing the Kessel Run to B1. But the problem is with all of those instances, when you know what the outcome is, you're just watching the inevitable. So
okay. So one thing that Jake's rewatch has been reaffirming in my mind, it's interesting. Sean's point, I immediately wanted to go towards him and on that because there are so many misses in my mind or things that have happened in Star Wars that I've been upset about as a fan over the years. But then, like I said, there's so many great things that have happened in that franchise that have happened to cinema because of Star Wars that I would look back at that scope and go, I'm glad it all happened, because it's one of those things where, yes, there are problems. But in regards to the prequels, we discussed this in the show before, and I'll keep this very quick. There are great scenes in those movies. The Phantom Menace has arguably my top 5 favorite Star Wars scene, which is the Darth Maul fight. That's one of my favorite
Star
Wars
scenes. Also, the pod racing scene holds up.
Agreed. That's a great scene, too.
I would just argue that more often than not, Star Wars fans are making excuses for things that don't work in the
saga. More often than not, Star Wars fans are assholes.
Well, that might be true also.
I mean, here's the thing. at the end of the day, out of all three of us, Jake is the biggest Star Wars fan
for sure.
Out of all of us. So when it comes down to true...
But an opinion matters. It doesn't matter how much of a fan you are.
I joke and I say that your opinion is about Jedi. Jedi is a good movie. You know, so Jedi, I would actually consider to be a hit. So real quick... We would go New Hope is a hit,
Empire.
Right? We all agree on that. Empire is a hit.
Let's
Jedi
say Jedi
is a hit.
Sure, let's say Jedi.
What do you mean, right? Let's say Jedi?
Let's
you
say
give
Jedi.
A pass Jedi, to Jedi, Jedi is Jedi?
A, yeah, Jedi
is a very good Star Wars movie.
George Lucas, right. Thanks you for your
Awakens.
Pass.
Force Awakens is
Force
a hit.
Force Awakens, that's 4.
Yeah. I'm calling Rogue One a hit because of the last scene. I'm
Come
sorry.
On.
The last
Rogue
scene
One,
is
are you kidding me?
The last scene of... Okay, Rogue One I did not love.
That's 5 already. That's at least half.
Well, and I'd argue Last Jedi also. So.
Gabe, this is actually something that we could look for in the future for a blend game. But I think we should do a game once where what the ending of a film saved the movie. Not ending blend, not best ending ever. But like Rogue One, for example. I didn't love Rogue One all the way up until that Vader sequence and that major fight at the end.
The last hour is the battle scene.
Right. But when I left Rogue One.
What do you mean one good scene? The last hour is the good scene.
Do you know what's the best Star Wars movie? Lord Miller's Solo.
Yeah.
South
okay.
Center.
If we're going to talk about franchises that have more misses than hits, there's only one good Back to the Future movie.
Okay,
oh,
now,
that's
There's
that's
only
ridiculous.
Two good okay. Indiana
that's,
Jones movies. Right,
that's ridiculous.
Jake, how many very few good Star Trek movies?
I love you.
You got to unplug
like,
your mic,
We
could
do this all day,
Stop.
Brother.
No,
don't
no.
do this. Don't
so
do
it's
this.
Funny. So the way we all talk, I went to college with two guys who we made short films with together. And last night we went to a Tool concert in D.C., and these are the exact discussions that we all have together. And we got into an actual debate last night about trilogies, and it was specifically came down to Back to the Future versus Star Wars. And I agree with my buddy Sean, and I agree with my buddy Josh on this. Back to the Future might be the most perfect trilogy of all time. It is It is so far beyond Star Wars.
Right.
It's not even the trilogy itself. The trilogy is way better than Star Wars.
Let me make an analogy. Let me make an analogy, and then Gabe, I promise we'll move off.
This is a good debate.
Gabe, imagine if they took Gabe is agreeing with me in silence, which gives me no help whatsoever.
Imagine if they took Back to the Future and made a prequel trilogy about George McFly.
Right.
And then years later made another trilogy about people that kind of knew Marty, but not really.
Right.
And forced you every couple of years to deeply care about this and say to you, this is really important to your childhood. Embrace this again. And it's not organic.
Do you know why they haven't done that? Because no one cares.
Okay. All right. So first of all, I don't know if Jake saw this or not. Jake, you saw the McFly spinoff, right? It was called McFly. McFly, a Back to the Future story. And so what they did was he's hoverboarding in this one scene, right?
Oh,
I get
it.
And a cop pulls him over.
Right.
And he was flying. So the cop goes, what's your name?
That scene. I just rewatched that scene. What's your name? I still don't see a problem with it.
And all of a sudden he goes, Michael J. Fox goes, I'm going to McDonald's on my hoverboard. He goes, oh, McFly. There we go.
All right.
That's the name.
So like last night.
That scene blew my mind, man. That was like, I was so happy about that scene.
Last night, Jake and I were able to see 1917. Kevin is going tonight. So we're going to talk about,
Before we move on, can we just at least mention the Star Wars, that video they put out with the montage? All I wanted to say about that was the Kevin thing.
Yeah, mention that scene.
And here's why I want to mention that.
Briefly.
And Kevin Smith talked about this publicly at the Q&A I just went to for Jay and Silent Bob Reboot. So we all know Mark Hamill's not in Reboot, right? And the story behind that was that Hamill, you know, the story he told on stage, I'm going to paraphrase him, was along the lines of when we made 2001, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, Star Wars was kind of not really a thing, right? I mean, Star Wars was kind of gone for a while. There was no new Star Wars. So when he went back to do Reboot, Disney, I don't know where the chain of command cut off or how it didn't happen, but the way Kevin tells the story is basically because Star Wars is such a big deal right now and Luke Skywalker, there was just no way that Mark Hamill could play Seenocker, which was the character he plays in, I'm not going to say the full word, but yeah, it's a bad word. But so that was the reasoning apparently behind him not being in Reboot. So here's my question. They release a Star Wars montage of all the years, and then they cut to Kevin Smith with a bong saber in a scene where he's about to fight Seenocker, played by Mark Hamill, in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. So I thought to myself after I saw that, one, that's amazing that Kevin Smith is part of that entirety, right? Because, I mean, like, Kevin Smith is actually a big reason why I love Star Wars. So like Kevin Smith's movies are kind of things that kind of got me more into the ideas of Star Wars and the
themes. Well, and JJ loves him. JJ's had him on both sets.
So my point really comes down to, could Hamill have been in Reboot if they were cool enough to include
Hamill
Kevin?
Hamill just voiced a murderous doll this summer. I know. If he wanted to be in Reboot, he could have been in Reboot.
No, I don't think it. The way Kevin tells the story is that it wasn't like Hamill wanted to do it, but it just wasn't. It wasn't the right fit because of where Disney and Star Wars are right now. I don't know who made the decision. That's the gist.
But
I
would have argued by that point, Hamill probably had already filmed Reboot, to which Hamill could have said, if he really wanted to, what are you going to do? Cut me out of Episode 9? Like what Disney? What power does Disney have over him at this point?
Do we even know he's in Episode 9?
Well, yeah, come on, dude.
I think he has to.
He tweeted me yesterday that there's a chance he'll be at the premiere.
He's not the only Skywalker, though. But that was cool to see Kevin Smith in there, so I just want to shout out to him for that. It was awesome.
All right, hop over to 1917. We're not going to get into any kind of spoilers. Not that it's a spoiler movie, but Kevin's going tonight. Gabe has not seen it yet, too. Jake, these are questions that Gabe has put into the doc. Did this disrupt, you don't have to even get into specifics, but did it disrupt your top 10?
It did, without question.
Wow.
It's, you know, it's that time of year, obviously, where we're seeing a lot of stuff that is made to be on our top 10 list. And I went into this sort of saying, like, I don't know how many more movies I can fit on my top 10. And it took all of about 20, 25 minutes for me to go, yep, this is top 10 for me. So, yeah, this is a major contender. And when it comes to voting, you know, because all of us vote for a lot of these award shows, not just a contender, but far and away my pick for several categories.
Okay. Are you willing to go? I've seen the word frontrunner thrown around a lot for this movie. Do you think it's that powerful?
You're talking about for Best Picture?
Yes.
I don't know if I'd call it the front runner. I feel like that word's being thrown around, but just because it's the last movie that that's been screened. And I feel like front runner, especially this Oscar season, front runner is just associated with what's the last movie I saw that you didn't see. And so I feel like that tends to be the front runner. I could, if this were one of those years, and I think it's going to be, where picture and director are split.
Okay.
I feel like this would fall more under the give it, like the director goes to Sam and picture potentially goes to maybe Hollywood or something. But Deakins, Deakins is a lock, right? Deakins is a lock.
It seems to be. I'd have to go see who the other contenders are. Oh my God, I had the worst brain fart in the world. I ran into somebody outside of 1917 and we were talking about Dunkirk and how it compares with Dunkirk. And I said, oh yeah, and Hoyt Van Hoytema shot that. And then the guy I was talking to I was like, who shot this with Mendes again? And he was like, it's Roger Deakins. And I was like, that's like the whole hook. It's the whole hook of the movie is who the cinematographer is. I felt so stupid. I was going to take all those words right back. How it affects the awards race. It's one of those movies where it just feels like the kid in it, I barely know who he is, and he could instantly get put into the best actor category. Like, it's the type of movie that's going to just carry everybody through because its technical brilliance is unparalleled. And so, all those below-the-line categories, obviously things like cinematography, editing. I can't wait till we can discuss this in full, and obviously I have to wait not only till Kevin and Gabe have seen it, but till more people have seen it, because there's just so many things I want to ask about, like, how did they film this movie? It's mind-blowing to me.
Well, no, I just tweeted out last night is that, I think all of us have a pretty good understanding of how movies work, like what it takes to make a movie. Like, we've all been on sets before. We sort of say like, okay, like this is it. I get it. May not have the capacity to do it ourselves, but I understand what it takes to pull it off. I don't really understand how he did that last night. Like, I get the idea of stitching, and that it's a lot of long shots stitched together. But even within those long shots, there are things that happen where I go, I didn't see a stitch there, and X, Y, and Z just happened. Yeah. And how did he pull all of that off with, I mean, we're not talking about, an atonement, people walking up one side of the beach, turning around and walking down the other side of the beach. We're talking like massive action sequences that have to go down to the wire. If you haven't seen the behind the scenes featurette that's on YouTube, it's worth your time, because the thing that they talk about that blows my mind is there are sequences where the camera might have to go 500 yards on a camera. And then to keep the shot going, they have to take the camera off the wire and put it on a Jeep. And then the Jeep's got to drive another 500 yards. And then someone's got to take the camera off the Jeep and then run with it down a field for 500 yards. And that's all one shot. And imagine being, we're all getting to interview the actors and the filmmakers in the coming weeks. I cannot wait to ask, like, what's the furthest you got into a shot and messed up? Like, where you could see the end of the shot and you messed up. That's what I want to know.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, because it's like 15 or 16 of those mind-blowing sequences together in one. Yeah. Like, we've all had those moments where you recognize that you're in a one-er and you're like, oh my God, like, they're doing this all in one shot. And the choreography of where the camera goes and where the act in relation to the actors, that's this entire movie for 2 hours. It's that experience for 2 hours where you just, and then you get, there's a few, I mentioned this on Twitter. I said there were four times out loud where I just was like, Jesus, Deakins. Like, are you kidding me?
The Deeks.
What are you doing? Like, what is this?
Let me ask you something.
Go easy on him.
I found myself doing something that I kind of hated myself for doing, and I made myself stop halfway through the movie, which I was counting the stitches. Every time I thought I could see one, I put a little mark down on a sheet of paper. And then I went, no, I got to stop. I got to stop doing that.
But it's funny that you say it, because I feel like I think this happens to us. It definitely happens to me. I'm speaking for you two guys also. I watch movies now with just through a different lens, where, like, as I'm absorbing stuff that's happening, I'm always like, oh, that's kind of cool how they did that. Like, I'm processing how they did it in the moment. Right. Like, so when you get to, and that's why I always say to somebody, like, if a movie makes my top 10, it's because at some point early on in that movie, I usually stop doing that. And I'm just so engrossed in the story or whatever's happening that I stop in my brain thinking, Oh, that's why they cut there. Oh, that's why they did this. Oh, look at how they did that. Oh, that's cool. How'd they pull that off kind of thing? I'm always sort of saying that. And when I can forget that and I'm just engrossed, and that's what happened with 1917, whereas, but I was playfully like you asking just like, how the hell? Like, where did they, it looks like he literally traveled back in time to 1917 and filmed in the middle of a battle.
Well, a master filmmaker is able, in my opinion, it enables the audience to simultaneously suspend disbelief in storytelling and also sit back and wonder how it's done and also appreciate the process. Like, I feel like a great filmmaker like Sam Mendes, I think Wes Anderson does this well. There's a lot of great filmmakers, in my opinion, that I can have a dueling mindset while I watch. And it's, to me, that is the pinnacle for me as a film goer.
I don't mean to be facetious when asking this question. I genuinely want to know, what does Wes Anderson do that you don't understand how he does? Like, well, like, maybe I'm not a big enough Wes Anderson fan to understand that. But
we're on two different topics. I'm referring to what Sean just said about when you're watching a movie that you can have the mental the element to stay in the story,
okay,
but also appreciate the filmmaking. Not
got it.
Not the idea of like how that was done. Like, for example, I'll watch a Wes Anderson film and he'll have a camera stationary and he'll violently go back and forth with it, like in Moonrise Kingdom as we go into the different rooms. Mm. And it's obviously drawing attention to a camera. And at the same time, I'm just sitting there going, I'm fully immersed in the story moment, but I'm also stepping back and going, oh my gosh, that's really cool what he's doing. But it never takes away from the story for me. And I think with something like 1917, I think the longest shot in the film, I think Deacon said it was 8.5 minutes. I was reading something, he was doing an interview recently. I think it's 8.5 minutes. And the stitching is an interesting thing. I actually find that to be fun. I thought Birdman was enhanced to me because I was watching for the stitches. I mean, to me, the master stitchers, the master stitcher, I guess if you want to call that, if it would be Alfred Hitchcock.
Rope
is exactly what Mendes did here on a different scale, clearly. Let me clarify the idea of marrying shots together, you know, on a smaller scale back then when you had these 10 minute film magazines, you would go behind Jimmy Stewart's jacket, cut, come back out, and you wouldn't even know the camera had cut. I mean, to me, that's fun. That makes Rope fun for me to like look for the cuts, look for where Mendes is going to be putting these in 1917. That being said, if he does it well enough, in my mind as a critic, it will land perfectly where I will not fully ever leave the immersion, but I will still be in it enough to appreciate the shot process. To me, and this is going to sound nerdy, I think a cinematographer is a character. I genuinely think that. I think Roger Deakins is just as much of a character in 1917. I haven't seen it yet, but the trailers make me believe this, as any actor in that film. I would argue that Hoyt Van Hoytema is the star of Dunkirk. And I genuinely feel that way. And so is Hans Zimmer.
Wow. So here's what I'll say. If you said that Deakins said that the longest shot is 8.5 minutes. If that's true, then there were a lot more stitches than I thought there were, because I thought all of the shots were between 12 to 15 minutes apiece. So if you're telling me the longest shot in that movie is, and I don't want to say only, but only 8.5 minutes, then damn.
He was estimating that the longest shots in the film were around 8.5 minutes. Now, that could be, he could be missing a big one. I don't know. I read a quote from him, but that's what I read.
All right, let's transition to this week in movies. We'll get deeper into 1917 after Kevin has seen it. Kevin, obviously, text us after you get out of the theater. I'm going to hear your reaction from down here in North Carolina.
I want to say one quick thing. I don't ever want to come across as someone who's trying to sound like a snarky film guy. That's not what I'm trying to do. I'm just coming at this from my perspective of how I watch films like this. And, you know, people can get on my case about 35 and digital. You're being too snarky. You're being whatever. And I get that. It's fine. But I want to make clarification that I don't ever want to come across as sounding like I know more or my mindset is different. You know what I mean? It's just my personal opinion on the matter.
Too late, McCarthy.
All right.
Just in case it came across that way.
This week in movies. Again, Gabe's going to slip one in that no one's ever heard of before. This is probably straight to video or maybe like a Hulu original. Has anyone heard of Almost Home? Almost Home.
Is that about a dog?
It sounds like it could be, right?
Honestly,
it could be
about a dog.
Homeward Bound just popped in my head right when you said that. Like, right
maybe
when,
it's like a Thanksgiving, like Jonathan Taylor Thomas is trying to get home for the holidays.
Oh, what's he doing?
He's probably in Almost Home.
JTT, right, anyway. Come on the podcast.
No one has seen Almost Home.
JT squared.
Kevin has seen Queen and Slim. Kevin, brief spoiler-free review of Queen and Slim.
Another movie shot on 35mm. First time feature filmmaker,
you
by the
pompous
way.
Ass.
Oh my God, you're so snarky.
I know. No, but in all honesty, this filmmaker, Melina, I'm trying to pronounce her last name, I think it's Matsoukas.
Okay.
She is the director of the film. She's done like a bunch of different like Beyonce videos. She shot this on 35. It looks incredible. Essential premise, Daniel Kaluuya's character and Jodie Turner Smith, who's her first feature film, I believe, as well. They're on a first date, a Tinder date. Something goes wrong. Police officer pulls them over. In self-defense, Daniel Kaluuya kills the police officer because he tries to fire at the woman, Jodie Turner Smith's character. And they go on a Bonnie and Clyde style run. And it's about that. It's about the time they share together while you're watching the film that really kind of blew me away. Daniel Kaluuya's accent, as an American accent, is truly one of the most remarkable things I've ever heard. I don't understand how he does it. And I'll never forget when I get actors do accents all the time. But when I saw Get Out, I didn't know who Daniel Kaluuya was. And when I walked in that interview room, I still didn't know who he was. I mean, I knew what the movie was. I had all my questions ready. But when he opened his mouth and started talking with his British accent, I was like taken completely back by it. Same thing with Jodie Turner Smith, who plays Queen in the film. Both heavily British accents, and they sound nothing like that. And I get that it's acting, but Daniel Kaluuya might have arguably one of the greatest American accents I've ever heard. I don't understand how he does it.
Dude, listen to him on our show. I mean, it's the most British slang insane. I've ever heard. It's like he's in a Guy Ritchie movie. I love this. It's the greatest.
Who did a great interview with him recently on Real Blend?
That was me. I got to talk to him.
But I'll say Queen and Slim is probably one of the most hard R-rated films I've seen in a long time. I was actually shocked
for violence.
No, it's more on the sexual side of it.
Oh,
I was talking.
Don't tell me anymore. I haven't seen it yet.
No, I won't say anything specific.
Tell me more.
That was so creepy.
I was after the film. I was talking to some of the other journalists who had seen the movie, and we were all agreeing that we hadn't seen a scene like that in a movie since like the 90s. Like,
wow.
like sex scenes in films have really changed a lot over the years. And obviously the MPAA is very specific about what they allow and what they don't allow. I just remember when I left that film, that's not the only thing I was thinking about. Obviously it's a very important film, but that scene, there's a scene that occurs in where I was like, how did that not get an NC-17? Wow. I was like, whoa, it's a great scene. It's actually arguably very well directed. But just a heads up, it's not for kids at
so
all.
So if Frozen 2 is sold out at the Thanksgiving box office,
Queen and Slim.
Don't grab Queen and Slim tickets for the whole family.
Let me just say this. Queen and Slim is a great movie. I absolutely loved it. Great performances. Very powerful. Very important. You know, I bring up these little details. The movie actually has some very funny moments in it. And it's very human, if that makes sense. It's very human. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I give it a 4.5 out of 5. Highly recommend seeing Queen and Slim, for sure.
Cool. Well, we've all been raving about Knives Out. That's the other film that's opening this Thanksgiving weekend. Obviously, we had Jamie Lee Curtis on last week's show, and we've got Rian Johnson in this week's episode. So we can scale the gushing back to a certain extent. I think you all know that the three of us are big fans of it. I will say this about Knives Out. It's a great ensemble comedy. It's got some tremendous lines in it. Rian Johnson wrote a really great script. It's paced beautifully. Everybody sort of gets a standout moment. But it's become one of those films that when I saw it, I thought, oh, that actually has a really good chance of making my top 10. And then in this year, it's not going to make it. And it's not a slight against the movie at all. It's a lot of fun. Kevin was saying this in last week's episode repeatedly. It bears repeating. It is a great audience movie.
It's amazing. It might be
my favorite movie I've seen with an audience this year.
Yep.
I'm with you, Sean, in that I think it got bumped out of my top 10, which kind of hurts my soul a little bit. that a movie that was my favorite audience experience of the year is not going to make my top 10. Like, that's what it says about 2019.
Yeah. And it didn't win the audience award, which is the weirdest thing I've ever heard of in my life. That award is designed to be an audience award. Now, granted, I have not seen Jojo Rabbit.
Come on, if you're going to give that movie to anything, you're going to give it to a movie about Nazis.
Yeah, I know. And I was in Princess of Wales when Jojo played, and I didn't think it. No offense to Jojo Rabbit, it didn't get a sliver of the reaction that Knives Out got in Toronto.
Jojo hasn't stuck with me the way I thought it was going to. I really enjoyed it.
I still haven't seen
Enjoyed it is a weird word, but I liked it when I saw it at the junket.
Right.
And then I think I maybe said, like, oh yeah, that's in contention for my top 10. And
yeah, you loved
know,
it.
And there, you know, for you know, and one of the X factors that you can never really account for when reviewing a movie, especially right after seeing, which is why I hate giving reactions right after I see a movie, is how it sticks with you. Sometimes a movie doesn't hit you. Kevin, you know, with your number one this year, sometimes a movie just doesn't quite affect you the way you think it's going to, but then it builds, it snowballs over time and becomes this masterpiece in your mind. And sometimes you walk out going like, oh, I liked that. And then you forget about it the next day. And that's in the latter is how I feel about Jojo Rabbit, which really surprised me. That it didn't really affect me the way that, I mean, like it's been a couple of months and I'm not thinking about it anymore, which I'm disappointed in.
Jake brings up something that I find insanely fascinating. This is something we can get into in another show. And maybe we'll turn it into a blend game, but we all don't have the luxury of rewatching films numerous amounts of times. And I wonder,
that being said, I have a DVD copy of 1917 in my home right now.
But that being said, though, my point is, like, I had the luxury of watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood four times, and it wasn't until the third and ending of the third and into the fourth that it became my favorite movie of the year. And what that does to my mind now is I wonder, looking back on this whole year, which other films would I need to watch four times to get to that point? And, like, that's why top tens are so interesting, is because in our top tens, how many times have we seen each of these films? Right. And, you know, when TIFF ended, Uncut Gems was my number two of the year, and it's been my number two of the year since. I've gone back and forth with, like, switching the spot up with another film specifically, which I'll get into when we do our top tens. But Uncut Gems has been my number two since then. I've only seen that movie once. If I've seen Uncut Gems four times, what happens to it? Does it go down? Does it go up? And I find that interesting because you have to bring those factors into your scale. I remember, I think our friend Kim Holcomb, who does reviews out in Seattle, she has a really interesting perspective on how she does reviews. I think it's Kim. When she gives her reviews, she'll tell people when she's on TV what her mindset was that day she watched it. So when you go into a film, let's say you worked a 15-hour day, you got home, your car broke down, you got into a horrible accident, your kid got an F on a report card, and then you sit down and watch
a horrible day.
I'm just saying, like,
you shouldn't watch a movie that day.
I'm giving exaggerations, but imagine, but that is an interesting perspective, right? Like, right now, like, you know, I'm going to see 1917 tonight. I'll have already put in a 12-hour workday at that point, which I'm not complaining whatsoever, but you got to think about where you are mentally, right? Like,
you
know what happens to me too? On a repeat viewing, if a movie doesn't hold up the way that I thought it might, or if it's just not, it didn't hit me as much, my question is always, what was the movie's job? Was the movie's job to work really well the one time, you know, that I saw it?
Yeah.
Or is it supposed to live up to repeat viewings? Is that the movie's fault, necessarily?
Interesting perspective. Yeah. I mean, these are things I think we should dive into this another point, another show. Maybe like a rewatch blend or something like that, where maybe we all rewatch a movie we only ever saw once. So, for example, mine would be Last Jedi. I only saw Last Jedi one time. So I'm very curious, now that I'm away from the hype, I'm away from the expectations, how that movie plays.
Gabe would like us to remind the audience that this started as a Knives Out conversation.
honestly, that's why we do. I know we're going off track, but anyways, yeah. Knives Out's amazing.
Star rating
we all
for
loved
Knives
it.
Out. Star rating.
Go see it. I give it a 4.5 out of 5.
Jake, I'd give it a 4.
I would give it a 4 also, but a very strong 4. 4.25.
Strong 4. Like a four that's been doing push-ups.
Don't be that jerk who gives that movie away. Do not be that jerk who ruins that for somebody. Please don't be that person, because that's a great ending. It's such a great ending.
It's a great ending, but it's also one of those ones that's like expertly constructed, that it reveals a lot of stuff early.
You're right.
And like, it's not like you're just waiting around like whodunit kind of thing. Sure. It's much the smarter
ending,
than that.
The ending is not my favorite part of it's that much movie. Smarter. I mean that as a compliment.
But that's the point of the ending, is that the ending is aware of how that structure works. All right, that's why it's cool. Yeah.
For this week's blend game, we are doing hashtag murder mystery blend in honor of Knives Out. And the parameters of what is a murder mystery, I think, can be up for debate. Is it a detective type story? Can you get into serial killer type things? So I'm going to make my pick first. And I'm going with one where, so I debated about this a lot. Like, I think that there are traditional murder mystery whodunit type films that are, contained to a single space, something like Clue, where everybody in the movie is kind of, it's similar to Knives Out, where everybody in the movie is kind of figuring out what's going on. There's been a murder. But then if you're calling something a murder mystery, I think you could also do like police detective type thriller. And so my pick is Seven. And then it's funny that like somebody on Twitter also said, does Seven count? I don't care whether it counts or not. This is my pick. And that's kind of how I feel also. Like, you can make an argument that Seven might not fit into this murder mystery, but there are a lot of murders. And they're trying to figure out who is behind these murders based on the seven deadly sins. And the reason why I'm going to argue that this does fit under murder mystery blend is that you do get to a reveal of somebody who is responsible for it. Now, it doesn't have that playful lark of movies like Knives Out or Clue. So it's far more depressing than that because it's made by the master David Fincher. But as we've discussed with Fincher over the years, if I'm picking favorites,
that's a great one.
Not over his best, I still think Seven ranks as my favorite film of Fincher's. Zodiac potentially being his best. He's made some masterful, masterful films. So my pick for Murder Mystery Blend is Seven. Now, Jake, I'm told
you
that
didn't go Zodiac.
No, I went Seven. I'm going Seven.
See, Zodiac seven would be an interesting choice because we don't know who the murderer is.
Correct.
Which is actually fascinating.
So it's thoroughly unsatisfying to me. I'm dismissing that that film, that hack work by Fincher. How dare he? But that's when we get to movie. Decade Blend, which we're going to do on our 100th episode, I think Social Network is going to be up at the top for me. I don't know. There's a lot of movies I'm debating over the decade, but we'll see how that plays out. All right, before we get too deep into that, why don't I throw it to Jake Hamilton to make his pick for hashtag murder mystery blend.
Well, you were questioning whether or not Seven was even an appropriate choice for this particular blend game. I also question whether or not it's the appropriate choice. In fact, I questioned it earlier today when I asked Gabe, does this work? Because Seven is also my pick for... Yes. Murder Mystery Blend. I mean, not only is it one of the my favorite murder mystery of all time, which I think it is absolutely appropriate for that. It's also just one of my all-time favorite movies. It's my favorite Fincher movie. It's up there with my favorite Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman movies. And I think it's a film noir, which I think if film noir doesn't fit murder mystery, then what does? Right. To me, it's just as much in the realm of like a Chinatown than anything else. Just the unnamed city, the fact that like it's this city that's grimy and wet and gross, but surrounded by a desert, it's never named. Like the city is never named. Like you never know what city it is that they're working in, which I love, because it could be any city and it could be any person. And it could be this could happen to anybody. I think the screenplay is tight and effective. The reveal, honestly, I think the Kevin Spacey reveal in Seven. Is 1,000 times better than the Kevin Spacey reveal in Usual Suspects. It hits me.
1,000 times better?
It hits me way harder. It seems more organic and less of a cinematic shock. Like the usual, like Kevin talks about a lot about moments in movies where the moment feels like it's in a movie, like it's aware that it's a movie. I like the Usual Suspects, but that movie feels like a movie moment. Like this, like that moment in Seven just feels like an organic, shocking. Like, how did I not see that? I mean, Kevin Spacey's in the movie earlier in the movie. He's in the stairway with them. He's the one taking the pictures.
You don't see him though.
You don't. But the fact that like they put him an Oscar winner right in front of us and we didn't even see him. I mean, like that we experienced Detective David Mills experienced, which is like he was right in front of us.
The three performances in that movie are so perfect. Like the cliches of the rookie, frustrated, adolescent cop who's all impulse and has no work experience, with the grizzled, you know, pending retirement cop, is so overdone.
Yeah. Like, you, it's the best even, version of a cliche.
You shouldn't even try it, right? Like, it's just terrible. Like, when you introduce it, and then those two do it, and you're like, oh my God, that's the greatest.
And as horrible as it sounds, John Doe's justification for his murders, like the car scene where they're driving out into the desert, and I think it's like a 10-minute long scene, and he justifies each of his murders. By no means am I saying that, like, I sympathize with the justifications or that I understand the justifications. Yeah. But you just sort of go like, oh, because I feel like a lot of those movies don't take the time to do that. And the writer of that movie did another movie that wasn't nearly as good, but also touches on something interesting. He wrote a movie called 8mm. And it was this really rough with Nick Cage, and Joel Schumacher directed it. And the end of the movie, spoiler alert, the movie's like 20 years old. You get to the killer who's done these unbelievably horrible, brutal things, and he has a similar moment where he sort of says, like, look, like, you know, I'm not a monster. You know, like, you know, daddy didn't abuse me. You know, I didn't get raped as a child. This didn't happen to me. X didn't happen to me. I just like to do this. And I like, to me, that's far more, that's so chilling. Like, hearing these guys justify in their minds and finding that logic in there is horrifying. And it's far and away my favorite murder mystery. 7, good choice, Sean.
Well, if we had all picked 7, Gabe would tell us to read them all out loud at the same time, which means Kevin has a different choice.
Yeah.
Kevin, wrap us up, murder mystery blend.
I went with Rope, primarily because I think it's arguably
nice little theme we have going on today.
Well, Rope is like, it's like the greatest murder mystery of all time. The dead body is right there, yes. And no one knows it. I mean, to me, that is, I mean, I know it's an adaptation, but I just found the way Hitchcock chose to direct that film, trying to make it look like it was continuous shots. But the idea of these two friends, or these two guys, strangling their former classmate, putting that body inside of like a wooden chest, and then inviting family and friends over to have dinner on the table where the dead body is, and then the entire anxiety of the film is them wondering where this guy is. Like, they're like, oh, is he late? Where is he at? It's so brilliant because the two guys are doing it to kind of see if they can get away with it. And like, aren't they trying to like impress Jimmy Stewart's character? Like, and Stewart's the one who starts really trying to like capture what happened and trying to.
Yeah. He's like their psychological teacher or something like that. A professor.
Yeah. Like they actually planned the murder based on previous sessions with that character.
God,
like,
it's such a good movie. You put me in the mood to watch that movie now.
But it's only an hour and 21 minutes, and it's just, and I remember seeing it when I was a kid. My dad and mom got me this Christmas present one year. It was this strangely red velvet Alfred Hitchcock collection. It came in this weird casing. It was made of velvet, and his face was like indented into the front of it, like the what do you call it? The silhouette of Hitchcock. And you would open it up with this really nice peeling back thing, and you would pull out these four disc cases that had four movies each inside of them of Hitchcock's career from the beginning to, you know, to towards the end. And Rope was in there, and I had never seen Rope before. That's kind of how I discovered that film. It was, you know, when I was a kid, I saw a movie that was made in 1948. I'm like, I don't want to watch 1948 movie. I was a young kid.
Is that really how old it is?
But I threw it on and I'm like, and I remember my buddy Chris, who was a film fan like me, telling me about how this was all like done, and like I just couldn't believe the lengths he went to get those shots, like just like going behind Jimmy Stewart's jacket or whatever it was. But to me, the ultimate murder mystery of a dead body being in the scene with the people trying to figure it out is just masterful. Like, what That's a great, great idea! And I know it's based on a previous work. I think it's a play, but it's just so well executed. Like it's one of my favorite murder mysteries. Probably my favorite murder mystery ever.
So Alexander Struntz writes in via the Real Blend email account, and he goes with the pick I almost went with too, another Hitchcock pick, Rear Window. Rear Window.
Oh, it's a great one.
Terrific, yes. William Unhock chooses Scream, the first Scream. Kimberly Sue at Rob the Mind, and several others went with Clue.
I honestly really did think about Clue for her because I do love that movie.
I've never seen Clue.
You've never seen Clue? Do you know the whole bit where they, like in theaters, they released it with different endings? You've never seen Clue either?
Yes.
No.
Oh, my gosh. It's so good.
No. Should we get a Clue? I know.
And Mac Rowden, who's listening to this right now, is fuming because I think Clue is one of his most favorite movies of all time. And here I am admitting right now as the managing director of Cinema Blend that I've not seen Clue. This.
Oh, my God. It's so good. They just had a screening at the Music Box Theater here in Chicago. And not only was it sold out, but the line for it was like wrapped around the corner of people who came out to see Clue on the big screen.
I mean, I know that it's really popular, and I'm sure that it's very, very funny. And I even believe I have a copy of it somewhere around here. I just have never. There's like a void from like end of high school, college age where I had a life, and I didn't see as much stuff. But that are like super 90s.
Like?
It's kind of glorious, actually. It's kind of glorious. So I just missed out on a lot of titles.
Back in.
Hey,
Hocus
Sean.
Pocus and stuff like that. Yeah, Kevin.
I was curious if you had read this story recently.
Oh, God.
Patrick Cranshaw, who was in the movie Old School, great actor. Did you hear about his favorite line in the history of movies?
Patrick Cranshaw, who is in, what was he in again? What?
He was in Old School.
Old School.
Yeah.
No, I don't know what it is. What is Patrick Crenshaw's favorite movie line of all time?
Well, he played the character Blue, so his favorite line of all time is, "You're my boy, Clue."
You know, these episodes could be a lot shorter if we just cut out all of this bullshit, man.
Oh, my God.
These could be nice, solid, 25-minute-long episodes.
The key now to these are to find the most random route
get
to the dumbest pun. I am fully aware of how stupid that is.
I'm sorry, now did the mission for them to come dumb? Like that started?
No, it's gotten to a point now where Dave's losing it. They've gotten to a point now where they've become so ridiculous that it's
dude,
almost better.
No, Scott Crenshaw? What's his name? Robert Crenshaw? Patrick Crenshaw. I swear you will never hear that name.
He played Blue, man.
Anywhere.
Dude,
I love Blue.
Blue's a great character.
All right, we're staying in the genres.
Is Blue a great character?
You're my boy, Blue. Come on.
He doesn't even say that line.
I know, but someone says it to him. Remember the Metallica song and they pick him up? Come on. Blue's amazing.
Next
Dude,
week,
you got to raise your bar, man.
I love Blue.
Next week.
So does Sean.
Staying in the genres. We played musical recently. We played murder mysteries. We're playing hashtag rom-com blend next week. So bring your favorite rom-com and tell us via social media at Real Blend. At email, realblend@cinemablend.com. No, I don't think so.
Wow.
And, you know, this is kind of fun because it's favorite now, at the very least. It's not doing best anymore. I don't think we did this, though. No. So let us know your pick through all of our various channels. And while you're at it, oh, wait, I got to do a review, don't I? Do we have a review this week, Gabe?
When are we doing Crenshaw blend?
Blue blend. Yes, we do have a listener review. Okay, here we go. This is from... All right, we're saving these for the end of the show now. This is from someone named... Fudgnu says, entertaining, educational, and excellent. All right, I'm going to like this one. In high school, I lived in a small town with no movie theater, yet every Friday morning, my mother and I looked forward to seeing Kevin McCarthy on Fox giving his movie reviews. I discovered Real Blend from following Kevin's Twitter, and I'm ever so glad that I did. I listened to this podcast walking to class, at the gym, and on the 9-hour drive back to that small town.
Wow.
The fact that I can listen to Sean, Jake, and Kevin's insights, then actually go see the movie in theaters is so satisfying that I can hardly contain myself. This is, first off, one of the best reviews I've ever heard in my entire life. These three are...
Very well written.
An ideal bridge between critic and audience. They see and understand things that I do not, yet they are able to enjoy the full picture that the film puts forward with an excitement that cinema deserves. Even so, the most striking aspect of this podcast is Gabe. No, I'm kidding. Is the way that interviewees obviously
kind of
appreciate
move.
The group.
I thought you were serious. That's pretty cool.
No, I was kidding. Even so, the most striking aspect of this podcast is the way that interviewees obviously appreciate the group, as they can sense the genuine excitement and passion about the field. This podcast features high-profile interviews, fun facts, behind-the-scenes information, and an enthusiasm that will make you want to talk about movies with all of your friends all day long until they are thoroughly annoyed. Highly recommend. That's the greatest review that we've received in a very, very long time.
We're probably also the only podcast who's ever mentioned Patrick Cranshaw on their show. We have that going for us.
I've already forgotten his name.
Guys, completely his filmography? Forgotten his name. He was in Hudsucker Proxy. He was in Bonnie and Clyde. We gotta do. We gotta respect Patrick Cranshaw.
Don't rattle off these names like you've been a lifelong fan. You just looked this guy up on IMDb. Don't act like you've got like a life size cardboard cutout of this guy in your home. Like you just looked this guy up.
Tweet us your favorite.
I didn't know
Patrick.
Patrick Cranshaw was until 15 minutes ago. I had absolutely no idea who he was. I know.
You're my boy, Clue.
It's amazing. Like, no, I didn't say it like that. I just genuinely think he has a pretty good filmography. I think we should be paying attention to this guy.
If you want to learn more about Patrick Cranshaw in person, come to our DC meetup. This is obviously episode number 94. Means we have 5 left until we record the 100th episode, which we will be doing in Washington,
D.C. Are we going to be able to get in 5 before?
Yeah. I think.
Sure.
Yeah. Why not?
Hey,
episode 99 is going to be 8 minutes long.
Hey, Sean.
Yes.
Just curious if you heard about Patrick Cranshaw.
Kevin, we
got to
go. You have a hard out.
But what about Patrick Cranshaw's favorite David Lynch film? Have you heard about this?
You're my boy, Blue Velvet.
Yes. You're my boy, Blue Velvet. Yes.
Thank you. All right. If you would like to RSVP for the DC meetup.
I hate this podcast. I really
do. It is going to be on Saturday, January 4th.
I'm embarrassed to be a part of this.
In Washington, D.C. To RSVP for the Real Blend meetup, because we only have a few slots left. We actually had to cap this off based on the response, which, again, amazing problem to have. And that is unbelievably cool of you guys. But if you want to go, if you have any intention of coming to it, sign up now. Go to this website, bit.ly/RealBlendDC. You can RSVP there. We're actually going to work out a ticket system because we're going to announce a venue relatively soon. Everything's starting to fall into place. We're trying to put together some really cool things for you guys for that Saturday. For those of you who are curious about where you can book a hotel, we're starting to get a couple of asks about the area. We're going to be in the Georgetown area. We can say that. Specific venue and exact time still just being finalized, but we'll be in Georgetown. So if you're looking for a place to stay, stay somewhere around there, stay around GW, take a cab or an Uber right over to the Georgetown area. And that's where we're going to be on Saturday the 4th. Okay, back next week.
Sean,
happy Thanksgiving to everybody. Yes, Kevin.
I got to do one more. I'm sorry, please. It's Thanksgiving.
You're killing Gabe. All right. Thanksgiving.
I will be grateful when this show is over.
Patrick Cranshaw's favorite Tyler Perry movie.
Oh, jeez. Hold on. Wait, give me a minute.
Jake, any guesses on this one?
No,
Jake knows this one. I don't know. What is it?
Blue, a Madea Halloween.
I got it right as you said it. Yes. I got it right as I thought
blue.
About Blue. Boo.
A Madea Halloween. Boot, and then Blue too. He loved
Lord
Blue too.
Lord knows
as well.
Why on earth you would want to follow us on social media, but if you want to, at Real Blend, at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, and at Sean_O'Connell. Please drop us a review on iTunes. Be nice. Like, I understand. Here comes.
I'm going to give us a bad review.
Sean, you are just as much in on these as I am.
I am. But I have to play the heavy, Kevin. I have to play.
Yeah,
I
do the cap. I get it.
That's my bit. Yeah. All right. We'll be back next week after Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. And thank you so much for tuning in. Until next week.
Dunkirk. Blue.
1917. It's better.
You're my boy. Boo.
When you said, you know, it's funny, like Blue Velvet, I was just going to say Blue Velvet, but you made it so much better by saying you're my boy, Blue Velvet.
You're my boy, Blue Velvet.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.